Introduction to Phase 2, Adulthood. Phase 2 of this book covers the adult years, roughly 30 to 60. The next 11 chapters relate to challenges of this period. Fasten your seatbelts. It's going to be a bumpy ride. Everything from sex, religion, and politics to taking risks and having mentors. Chapter 5, Explorations in Medicine, from Slime Mold to Jimmy Kimmel. On my journey to discover my life's calling, I've had exposure to medicine in a variety of settings. A state hospital for the severely retarded, a big city emergency room, hospital pathology department as an autopsy assistant, a locked psychiatric ward, and a venereal disease clinic in a health department. After getting my BA in psychology, in my mid-20s, I decided to go to medical school, to become a doctor. Against the odds. I'd never been much of a student. I had no medical people in my family. I didn't have what you might call a caring or healing personality. Nevertheless, after I got bit by the doctor bug, I felt if I really applied myself at age 27, maybe I could do this. What followed was a whole new direction in my life, science. The next 3 years of my life were an unforgettable roller coaster ride of peculiar jobs, academic new directions, and a total 24/7 commitment. In this chapter, I'll tell you about my pre-med adventure, then about my relationship to medicine in my elder years, and I'll end with a rant about how screwed up our healthcare system is. It all started with my first job out of college. I worked for the United States Public Health Service in the Berkeley City Health Department. My job title, venereal disease epidemiologist. Part 1, LSD and slime mold. Working in the VD clinic opened up a whole new world. I interviewed VD patients, worked with doctors and nurses, even social workers. On clinic days, I slipped into a white lab coat, put on rubber gloves, and was allowed to take specimens from the male patients. I really connected with this medical stuff. In high school, I remember taking a biology class and being knocked out when I peered through a microscope and saw an onion skin for the first time. Blew me away. In a college biology class, I did, quote, research on nematodes in a frog's stomach. But at 24, with a degree in psychology, I had zero idea what I wanted to do with my life. My friend Brad Ellman, also a psychology major, told me one time that a BA in psychology will let you do anything you want, except be a psychologist. It dawned on me, maybe, just maybe, I should consider medical school. Ridiculous. I wasn't smart enough. I'd avoided science in college, fulfilling my science requirement with geology. There were no doctors in my family. How could I possibly do this? Yet the idea began to grow. I became obsessed with this idea that maybe, if I really applied myself like never before, I could become a doctor. It seemed to me that the doctors in the clinic weren't any smarter than me. I had no family, no responsibilities. If I became a monk and studied my ass off, bet I could get into medical school. Well, that is exactly what I did. I got a job working in the lab at Herrick Hospital in Berkeley as an autopsy assistant called a deaner. And at night, I took classes in algebra, you know, the beginning classes, x plus y equals 10. If x is 7, what is y? Pretty basic stuff. I'd never in my life been so committed to a goal. Nothing else mattered. Day and night, school, study, work, school, study, work, 24/7. For the next 3 years, I worked my way through the pre-med curriculum: chemistry, physics, bacteriology, genetics, physiology, zoology, cell physiology, etc. To my surprise, I did pretty well in science, and I liked it a lot. No longer afraid of the quadratic equation, or learning the formula for how the benzene ring was discovered, quantum mechanics, semipermeable membranes, the Krebs cycle, discovery of the double helix, The list goes on and on. I even had the top grade in my organic chemistry class at SF State. Pretty good score on the MCAT, Medical College Admission Test. Who'd have thunk it? But I was 29 when I got my second rejection letter. Maybe this isn't right for me after all. Almost overnight, I lost interest in science. Humanistic psychology was back on my radar. Carl Rogers, Rollo May, Abe Maslow. A new career transition took place. Psychology out the front windshield, medical school and biology in the rearview mirror. From that day to this, I have never regretted those 3 years of science. Years later, thinking back on my medical school application adventure, it hit me like a 2x4. This whole plan was ill-fated from the beginning. No doctors in my family. I wasn't that good in school. No interest in being a healer. The whole program was about me trying to show my first grade teacher I'm smart. Remember the teacher who put me in the slow reading group? Well, I'll tell you, that's not a really good reason to devote my life to the study of medicine. Plus, she'd already been dead for 20 years. Along the way, though, there were some unforgettable moments. Lessons I learned cutting up bodies. Now, you might think being an autopsy assistant is a pretty weird way to make a living while you're in college, but I'll tell you this, it was a great way to learn anatomy and some physiology. Every day I assisted these two pathologists dissecting cadavers. My job was to prepare the bodies. I also disposed of various body parts that came down from surgery in the furnace in the basement. After getting over the initial revulsion of my new job, I was amazed at how much I was learning. Here are a few of my key takeaways. It can't happen to me. During my autopsy days, I was a pack-a-day straight camel smoker. So was the pathologist I was working with. We'd be working over somebody who had died of lung cancer and smoking away while ashes dropped into the chest cavity of the cadaver. Specimens of the black lung tissue sank to the bottom of the formaldehyde specimen jar. Didn't faze us. We kept puffing away and laughing. Diet and coronaries. The way that plaque hardens and calcifies the arteries was shocking to see and to feel. On larger arteries like the descending thoracic aorta, plaque would be so dense it could be peeled away like bark off a tree trunk. In the coronary arteries, the plaque was often so thick and hard that the artery could be snapped like a twig. The blockage, or stenosis, meant that the heart muscle downstream got no life-saving blood. The heart muscle tissue would be so necrotic or dead, I could literally poke my finger through the wall of the heart. Consistently, we'd notice that the coronaries of Asians of, say, 75 years old would be as flexible as those of Caucasians of, say, 35. The Asian diet of less red meat and more fish and vegetables explained the difference in coronary plaque deposits. I still ate hamburgers and smoked, though. The truth came out in post. Autopsy. The patient was an overweight 45-year-old female. She had died that morning of complications from high blood pressure. The treating physician was in attendance along with three other doctors. He was explaining his diagnosis and treatment. He seemed confused about why she died, explaining that he had given her XYZ drug to thin her blood. The other doctors looked concerned. One explained that a side effect of that medication actually caused blood thickening. Ooh, awkward silence. The doctor's mistake had killed his patient. I just looked at the floor. Overall, my year as a deaner proved invaluable to my future undergraduate biology classes, especially anatomy and physiology. After a few weeks of getting used to working with dead people, I was slinging those corpses in and out of the refrigerator like a pro. Unforgettable. Bacteriology. One of my favorite classes at San Francisco State was my 5-unit bacteriology class. Occasionally, while doing my reading assignments, I'd smoke a joint. While that almost always slowed down my reading and my comprehension, this one evening the pot gave me a biological, mystical experience. I was reading about how penicillin kills bacteria by disrupting the molecular structure of the bacterial cell wall. I kept rereading this one page and saying out loud over and over, "Oh man, oh, this is some good shit. Oh, gram-positive bacteria. Ooh, synthesis of the bacterial cell wall. Penicillin has similar molecular structure of the bacterial cell wall. They bind to the cell membrane, altering this. God, this is so far out. They change the cell membrane and makes the cell disrupt, and it disrupts the osmotic balance and inhibits the cell wall synthesis. Whoa, how fucking cool is this? Cell synthesis, cell wall, semi-permeable membrane. Jesus, God, this is amazing." Actually, all that had huge meaning for me. I was in the first grade when I came down with bronchial pneumonia. I was hospitalized for a week and put on high doses of penicillin, which had only been brought to market in 1945. So hooray for the molecular structure of penicillin and its ability to disrupt the cell synthesis. Without it, I doubt that I would be here today speaking these words. LSD and slime mold. While I was going to SF State taking biology, I had my one and only LSD trip. Afterwards, my guru, David Dion, gave me a tab of LSD. One of my favorite classes was cell physiology. We studied such cool things as semi-permeable membranes. I became fascinated with a single-cell organism called the slime mold. Under a microscope, it looks like an amoeba without cell walls. Its guts, or cytoplasm, flows back and forth in what is called Brownian motion. For my semester project, I decided to see what different chemicals would do to the structure of this weird organism. I had seen studies done giving spiders drugs to see what effect that would have on their web making. A spider given LSD makes the strangest looking web you can imagine. Using the same idea, I wanted to see what different chemicals would do to the structure of the slime mold. I mounted an 8mm movie camera on a microscope and filmed the effect, giving my slime mold doses of water, H2O, salt water, sodium chloride, and LSD, lysergic acid diethylamide. For my report, I showed my film and listed the doses and the results of the chemicals I'd applied. When I wrote the words lysergic acid diethylamide on the board, about half the class cracked up, including the professor. Remember, this was the late 1960s in San Francisco. Here are the experimental results. Water just made the slime mold fatter. Salt water caused the rupture of the cell wall. LSD caused the whole thing to take on a very weird shape. Who knows what it did to the consciousness of the poor old slime mold. I got an A on the project. By the way, if you are a member of the SPCSM, Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Slime Mold, be advised that no slime mold was injured during this study. Our lab organisms were nursed back to health after the drug study. The organism that got the LSD, however, always seemed a little odd afterwards. I suspect he had turned on, tuned in, and dropped out. Part 2. Slithering into Decrepitude. Transient Global Amnesia. Ah, the joys of growing old. Hey, you 30-something people out there, listen up. This is what you have to look forward to. Right now, everything is working fine, right? Your bones, your joints, back, brain, eyesight, hearing, all good. Treasure these days, they go by so fast. Faster than you'd imagine, you'll find that conversations with friends begin turning to aches and pains, and the latest MRI, and even trips to the ER. For example, after months of bleeding, my wife Mary had a complete hysterectomy on Thursday, January 22, 2015. Today's medicine is amazing, especially surgery with laparoscopy. She went into the OR at 8:30 in the morning and was in the recovery room by 11:30 and walking around by 1:30 and home in bed resting by 3:30. She had little pain and got by on 2 Vicodins. Mostly she managed on Advil. The healing process was very smooth. The night before Mary went to the hospital, our daughter Katie was anxious about it and wrote an unforgettable poem on Mary's back with a Sharpie. It said, "You are a beautiful, independent woman, no matter what. You have forever changed my life. No matter if you have lady parts or not, you are the number one woman in my life." The OR team loved it. I stayed with Mary during the pre-op preparations, which included a visit from the 2 surgeons who were doing the operation. As they explained what would happen, I jumped into the conversation, feigning surprise. "What? Does this mean we can't have any more children?" No one laughed. Not the first time my humor has fallen flat. Well, I'd been enjoying this role of caregiver, though there wasn't much to do. As my daughter said to me, "How can we be Florence Nightingale when the patient refuses to be sick?" Mary was recovering beautifully. Whatever minor things she needed, I was there to help. Lots of emails, candy, food, flowers poured in. Everything went smoothly until I had a brain fart. Now, I don't know if I was secretly pissed off that she was getting so much attention, but Sunday morning, Mary had to take me to the emergency room because of a little episode in my brain. Now, I remember Saturday clearly. I went to a writing seminar during the day, and we had a quiet evening at home. But Sunday morning is a blur. Mary found me wandering around the house, not sure what I was doing. She asked me a few questions and didn't like the answers. She called the advice nurse, who said, "Get him to the ER right now." What happened from that time until 2 or 3 in the afternoon is a complete blank for me. I had what's known as a TGA, transient global amnesia event. Usually this happens to people over 50. It lasts several hours and clears up without treatment. The cause is uncertain, but it could be related to migraines, anxiety, physical exertion, alcohol, or having sex. All are cited in Google as possible causes. I do and did all those things. During the episode, I remember feeling relaxed. Mary was there and I was getting first-class care in the new Redwood City Kaiser Emergency Room. I was cracking jokes and making astute observations, even though I couldn't remember how the hell I got there. The ER doctor showed me a sheet of paper with various objects on it that I was to identify: a shovel, a bicycle, a garden hose. Ever the smartass, I said to the doctor, "Hey, I'm a psychologist. I give those goddamn tests. I don't take them." He was not amused, but I passed with flying colors. The results were clear. I had a TGA, not a stroke. My treatment was to go home, take an aspirin, and see the neurologist just for kicks. After 2 p.m., my memory came back. Moral of the story: we can be grateful for the science of modern medicine and the quality of health care. I'm also grateful to those bleeding heart liberals of the 1960s who invented Medicare. And by the way, Kaiser rocks. So after this adventuresome weekend, I wrote this up on my blog and got some fabulous responses back. Feedback. One of my favorites is from Deborah. She said, oh dear, you two sure know how to keep things interesting. So glad you're okay, but still, it's a scary time for all of us and will continue to be so as we slither into decrepitude. Love the idea that we're slithering. Here are a few more I liked. Transient global amnesia is the brain's way of taking a holiday. Maybe it's just having trouble getting used to you being retired. Yes, old age isn't easy, but aren't we glad to have it? Brain farts, wise farts, old farts, that we are. Now you and Mary stay out of the ER, no matter how much you like Kaiser. Wow, might as well pack it all into one weekend and have it done with. Perhaps the most fun of all was from my old friend John Hutchison, who said, "What's wrong with walking around in a daze?" A year later, I had my cataracts done. Here's the story in front of a live audience. The big laugh comes when I showed them a photo of my face with two black arrows done with eyeliner pointing to my right eye.
Now, I see a lot of gray-haired people out here. I'll bet you that you've had your cataracts done, or you're thinking about it. Well, I desperately wanted my cataracts done because everybody, all my friends said, your vision clears up, it's terrific. And I kept going to the optometrist, I said, am I ready? And they would, you know, they put this stuff on your eyes and they would say, no, you're not ripe. You have to be ripe. So I wasn't ripe. So I kept going back year after year. Finally, the guy says, you're ready. So I said, this is great. I'm going to get my cataracts done. Now, in order to do this, you have to go through a whole bunch of training. I mean, I'm sure they can chop your leg off and not have to go through all this stuff. I had to go see a movie. I had to be in a group process thing, and there was a nurse and a doctor, and I had to see the surgeon and several other nurses. By the time I got ready, I hadn't even had the surgery yet on my left eye. So the last nurse I was talking to, I was sort of fed up with it. I said, you know, I'm pretty nervous about this procedure. Why? We've done thousands of them. It's very safe. Yeah, I know, but this image keeps haunting me. Really? What's that? Well, I imagine that you have me on the table, and my head is in a vise, like this. I'm looking up, you know, and you've got my eyeball propped open like this, and the surgeon has popped out my lens, and then guess what happens? We have our 8.5, 15-second earthquake, and the joint's going like this, and ceiling tiles are falling, you guys are running for cover, leaving me on the table. And I'm sitting there saying, oh, shit, if I sit up, the vitreous humor, my eyeball is going to roll out, and my eyeball is going to collapse on itself. My, you certainly can go to the dark side. Well, then it came time to have the right eye done. You know, they give you about 3 weeks. And those of you that have had procedures, and those of you with the gray hair and maybe some others here, you've had procedures. We call them procedures. Oftentimes it's in and out. It's just a one-day deal. And one of the things I've noticed is when I have procedures, they really want to make sure that everything's on the up and up and that there's no confusion. So I walk in and I've got this band, this wristband, right? Big old thing, maybe orange or something, pink. All right, you're Frederick Gilbert. Is that Frederick Gilbert? Have I got that right? Frederick Gilbert. And we're doing your right cataract. We're not cutting off your left leg. Is that right? Yes. Right cataract, not left leg, Frederick Gilbert. And you go to the next room. Now, you're Frederick Gilbert. It goes on and on. Well, I got tired of all that. So stupid. It's just for the lawyers, you know? So when I had my right eye done, right before I left the house for this surgery, I took some eyebrow pencil to make it easier for them.
Okay, enough about me. Let's consider some bigger issues, like medical aid in dying and health care in the United States. Part 3, Health Care Policy. Dan Diaz. For years, I've been supporting the medical aid in dying movement. A few years ago, as states around the country were fighting to make it legal, the entire movement got a huge boost with the death of Brittany Maynard, a 29-year-old woman stricken with a terminal brain tumor. She became the poster child for the movement when People magazine ran a cover story about her. She and her husband, Dan Diaz, had to move from California to Oregon in order for Brittany to legally end her life and avoid the horrible suffering that was in store for her. I attended a promotional luncheon for Compassion and Choices in San Francisco where Brittany's husband spoke. After the luncheon, he gave me a few minutes for a brief interview. What struck me most was the loneliness he feels at night without Brittany.
She fell asleep within 5 minutes. And her breathing slowed. Within 30 minutes, she passed away. On that day when she decided that, you know, her suffering had gotten to a point where It was getting to be too much. And then also the symptoms that were coming for her, she would have gone blind. She would have lost her eyesight. She would have become paralyzed. And then she would have been stuck in the bed with tubes coming in and out of her because now she can't get out of bed. And that was a death that she says, no, I won't. I will avoid that. I do not want to go through that way of dying. So on that day, it was a very peaceful thing. Mm-hmm. And there wasn't
that sense of control. That you're not so much a victim at this point.
That's it. There wasn't an anxiety or fear or a struggle. It was more of she had the opportunity to tell those, the people that mattered in her life, I love you and thank you. And, you know, the things that a lot of times I think people don't get the opportunity, she had that. So her passing was very peaceful. We were just married. She was 29 years old and we were looking to start a family and we got the diagnosis that she had a brain tumor, and that's really when it brought this into our consciousness, thinking about, okay, if the brain tumor is allowed to run its course, the way that she will die will be a very painful, very, very painful passing. And so the idea of needing to move to Oregon, because in California, that it wasn't an option, has been beneficial from a healing perspective, because I am carrying on what Brittany started. And truly would be foolish to squander the wave of momentum that she began. So in that regard, there is a certain amount of fulfillment in doing the very thing that Brittany asked of me and that I promised her that I would work on. Legislation in as many states possible. My focus being on California, of course, because that's our home state, but I've talked with senators in New Jersey and New York as well. And if Compassion and Choices, when they set up interviews or opportunities to have conversations with whatever elected official, I'll make myself available.
If you look at the journey that you're on now, tell me a little about the highs and lows.
There's days where there's just frustration that, like, when I step back and look and think, wow, my life has changed so much and I don't have person that I love most with me, and she's gone. So those are the lows, just, you know.
Late at night, I suppose.
Yeah, at night when the house is quiet, missing my wife. And then, you know, the flip side would be working on advocating and making a difference and seeing that maybe I help convince a state senator, or maybe the interview that I gave will reach a different demographic and get people thinking about this and involved, then, you know, those would be the points where there's a certain amount of fulfillment.
So in a sense, the tragedy that you and your family have gone through may result in huge progress and good things for other people.
I hope so. And Brittany said that in one of her interviews herself, where the change that she was looking to bring about was for people that she'll never meet. She spoke up. And she knew that it was in the spirit of being a benefit for others, specifically in California, and with the hope that nobody in California has to go through what we went through, which is to up and move to another state during a time of absolute chaos. So.
Although Dan Diaz doesn't discuss this, an important question here might be, who's making money from keeping sick people alive? For example, if Brittany had been denied her death with dignity and been forced to live out the next 4 or 5 months of her life in great agony, who would make money from this? The insurance companies? Local oncologists? Nursing care agencies? Drug companies? Absolutely. You see, there's no profit in letting Brittany die on her own terms. Who else makes money by denying patients medical aid in dying? The nursing home industry? The assisted living industry, the hospice industry, geriatric medicine physicians, pharmaceutical industry, you bet. Pair all of this with conservative religions who believe only God can take a life, and there will be huge resistance to the medical aid in dying movement. Recent surveys show that 73% of the population supports this movement and want the decision of their own departing in their own hands, not religion and not the government. Unfortunately, many politicians are terrified of religious backlash, so they drag their feet on changing the laws. Ah, to paraphrase John Kennedy's book title, profiles in cowardice. So what about our current healthcare insurance system? Working well for us? Well, yes, if you're wealthy. Jimmy Kimmel. Pop quiz. The purpose of our healthcare system is to 1. Provide excellent healthcare for citizens of our country. 2. Make the financial elite at the top even more wealthy than they are already. If you chose number 2, bingo, you win. Right you are. If you chose number 1, you need to pull your head out of the sand. This all blew sky high for me recently, when talk show host and comedian Jimmy Kimmel had a tearful monologue about his gratitude to the medical community who saved his newborn baby. The baby had a possible fatal heart problem. Here's how I dealt with it on my blog.
Hi. My frustration with this whole debate about healthcare continues to grow. I really went over the top, though, this morning when I saw a replay of Jimmy Kimmel's tearful, emotional talk to his audience last night. It lasted about 10 minutes. He was explaining that he just had a new baby and the baby had a horrible heart defect. And he spent all of this time thanking the people who had helped him, all of the medical people and all the staff and everything, even his family. And of course, the audience loved it. They were cheering him on. And it was very emotional, and everybody could identify with what a parent must go through when a child is suddenly hit with a very terrible illness. As I watched all of this, when it was all done, the one thought that ran through my mind was, oh, cry me a river. Now, before you all write me angry emails, let me finish up what I meant here. I have sympathy for the thing he went through. I have sympathy for his child. I'm very glad that everything worked out okay, thanks to the exquisite medical care that he got. What was missing for me in his talk was something about how you pay for all of this. No content at all about how much all of this cost. My guess would be that the incredibly top of the line medical treatment that his child got must have cost $500,000 at least. Who paid for that? Well, of course, it was his insurance company, his healthcare insurance company. And you can bet that Jimmy Kimmel has a top of the line healthcare insurance company watching out for him. Of course, he is a extremely wealthy, very, very successful late night show comedian, white. And so it went great for him. Who can complain? The audience all applauds. Yes, we all want health care for everybody. We do, yes. Of course, no talk at all about how we're going to pay for that. That's what made me angry about this. Let's think for a minute about the same situation, except the patient whose new baby has this horrible heart defect has dark skin. And let's also say that this dark-skinned parents come in and the father works a minimum wage job for $12 an hour at McDonald's, let's say. What do you think the chances are that that family would get the same kind of care that Kimmel got? They might even have health care insurance, but their deductibles, because they can't afford a very good program, their deductibles are maybe $50,000. If you're working at a minimum wage job, you don't have $50,000. My point here is that this seems to be again and again and again the thing that we're hearing is how in this healthcare debate, the insurance companies have to make money. They have high paid executives, they have shareholders, they have huge advertising budgets, and that's where they have to make their money. I watched the other day in horror as on CNN, a congressman from Pennsylvania, a Republican congressman from Pennsylvania named Mike Kelly was being interviewed. And he explained in a kind of condescending way to the interviewer that, well, you know, this is just a business decision. And if you have very high-cost patients that have pre-existing conditions, like Kimmel's baby did, then the insurance companies have to charge more because otherwise they're going to lose money on the deal. In watching this interview with Mike Kelly, my hair was on fire. I could not believe his attitude. He was so patronizing to the interviewer, explaining about how business works. And he said something I want to read to you word for word. He said, "The greater the risks, the greater the premium. You see, honey, this is a business decision." Well, Mike Kelly, let me tell you something. That's the way business works. And business has no goddamn place in healthcare. Get out of it. Let it be run by the government so doctors can practice medicine instead of filling out a lot of forms. And let's upgrade our entire healthcare system by getting the profit motive out of it. That's my message for you, Mike Kelly, Republican from Pennsylvania. And that's what we see going on in Congress right now, is a fight over how much money is going to be lost and who's going to get screwed in the deal. And I'll tell you who's going to get screwed in the deal, and I guarantee you this, it's the people at the bottom. And the people at the top, money's going to flow right to them, to the big insurance companies, the executives, the shareholders. They'll do just fine. But it's the people at the bottom that are going to get screwed. I'm fed up with this. I think it's about time that we stand up for a single-payer healthcare plan, get rid of these healthcare companies, and have a government plan that would be paid for through our taxes. If we consolidate all of our efforts, we should be able to help people that don't have any money get good health care just the same as people who have a lot of money. What's wrong with that system? So I urge you to think about how can we move our health care debate out of this whole issue of profit. Profit motive has to be profit. And think in terms of a socialized model where we're all covered because we all pay taxes. And it doesn't matter if you're a young person and healthy, and you say, well, I don't have to. Why should I buy health care? I'm young and I'm healthy. Oh, bullshit. Come on, this is not the way it works. If everybody pays, whether you're young and old and in poor health, or you're young and healthy and you have money or you don't have money, we all pay into a common fund and we're all covered that way. By the way, it's exactly how car insurance works. If you're a very good driver, they don't say to you, well, never mind, you don't need car insurance. The state mandates that you have insurance. And that's the way I think we should do it in this healthcare program. Now, I am very happy that everything turned out good for Jimmy Kimmel's baby. But what I'm irritated about is we are still living in Never Never Land. The audience all applauds. Oh, yes, yes. Oh, we all need good health care for everybody. Yes, yes. By the way, how are we going to do this? Because as far as I can tell, these healthcare insurance companies are greedy bastards who want it all, going to go right to the top for them. And the little guy, my mythical $12 an hour McDonald's employee, yeah, good luck with your $50,000 deductible. So let's make some noise. Let's let people know that we're sick of this for-profit healthcare system. It's about time that we pool our resources and take care of all of us all together.
Summary. As a young person in my adulthood years, I learned a lot about medicine through my pre-med studies and my work in hospitals. Now in my elderhood years, I'm learning through first-hand experience, often which I'd just as soon not learn. In any event, with good genes, healthy lifestyle, modern surgery and antibiotics, many of us can expect to live into our 80s or even our 90s. Compared to previous generations, we hit the medical jackpot. Now in Chapter 6, we'll explore how life in the adult years often throws us a curveball. Sometimes, though not always, life after major screw-ups actually gets better.